Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Environmental and Natural Resources Forum, and your chair and moderator for tonight's program. Carrie Curtis, the chair of our Environmental and Natural Resources Forum, will also join us during the questioning period. It is my pleasure to introduce tonight's distinguished guest, Martin Malarva, CEO of Malarva Incorporated, a third-generation family business with its headquarters in Savannah, Georgia. Martin has a PhD in English and American Literature from Harvard and an MBA from the Kellogg School of Management, Northwestern University. He, his family, and their company have pioneered and are committed to corporate sustainability, LEED green commercial and residential building, and real estate and enhancing local communities. His book, Living Above the Store, Building a Business That Creates Value, Inspires Change, and Restores Land and Community, is indeed inspiring, and it is available here for purchase and signing after the talk tonight. Please welcome Martin to the Commonwealth Club.
Thanks, Anna. Thank you for the welcome, and thank you to the Commonwealth Club. It really is an honor to be here. Can you hear me okay? Yeah, good. I'm going to depart a good bit from my book. Not much of a self-promoter to begin with. I usually like to start with a story in most of my talks, and tonight is no different. But it's going to take me a bit of time to frame the story. As most of you are well aware, there's a whole cottage industry of books, blogs, webs, conferences on sustainability. What is it? What do we do? How do we go about it? What are the problems? What are the challenges, et cetera? And if I can be reductive for maybe a few minutes, is to say, if I could boil this down, that basically, if we want to reduce our use of resources and our practice regarding waste so that we're living within our carrying capacity, I think it really simply calls for three things. I would say, go so far as maybe to say that serve as both necessary and sufficient conditions for a sustainable revolution. I realize that's a bit of a reach, but here goes. Three necessary and sufficient conditions. One is to focus on what I would say are a handful of thought leadership concepts, big picture ideas out there, at the risk of being a bit philistine and in the midst of a very literate audience and a literate environment. I would say that despite the fact that there are just a ton of books on the subject, there probably are about a handful of books out there today that really get big picture at what we need to do to shift things around. And that would be something like Peter Barnes's Capitalism 3.0, where you convert much of the use of natural resources to trusts of various types. George Monbiot's study of what it would take to reduce our carbon emissions to 80% of 80% reduction of what we use now. E.F. Schumacher and the idea of small businesses globally, green-collar economy. I think if you look at the literature today on sustainability, there are a handful of big ideas that if we just stopped reading and stopped talking and actually implemented, we'd be a long way along the way. And that would even include my book, I would say. So that's one. Let's focus on a few, couple of big-ticket ideas. The second is shaping congruent action among the various social sectors of society, business, government, academia, civil service or NGOs, faith-based organizations. Typically, historically, since the second industrial revolution, first industrial revolution, most of these have functioned in a tribal fashion, have not worked in collaborative fashion. I would say that's condition number two. And the third is replacing our outdated stories that have informed our behaviors and our beliefs over the past several centuries with a new compelling set of stories. So focus on a handful of ideas, collective use, work across social sectors, and three, telling a new set of stories. And it's that third condition, the telling of a new set of stories, that I want to talk and discuss with you tonight. It's about mythologies. I'm an English major, and I come back to stories at the end of the day. More specifically, the myths we've inherited and oftentimes hold onto without ever questioning, and the need to let those mythologies go in place of new mythologies or stories that we need to shape. So it really is, if you break that down into three things. One, recognizing the mythologies that are deeply embedded within us all, oftentimes unrecognizable. Two, saying goodbye to those mythologies. And three, shaping a new set of stories, shaping a new set of mythologies. And it's my feeling that for a sustainability movement or revolution to truly gain traction, those three things must occur. And I'll be drawing a bit on a very detailed way of my own work with my own company, Malavar Inc. But for the moment, I'd like to step back and draw upon three authors, writers, thinkers that probably you all are familiar with. And these are people that I admire very much and I think help shape those three concepts. There's Warren Bennis, who's a guru in business leadership. I'm sure you probably all know. Jared Diamond, the geographer, historian, and Frank Kermode, the literary critic, if you know Frank Kermode's work. So Warren Bennis, a book on becoming a leader, probably one of my favorite books. And Bennis writes a lot about the need for adaptive capacity as leaders. And adaptive capacity for Bennis can be boiled down to this very succinct two sentences. This is what he says. To free ourselves from habit, to resolve the paradoxes, to transcend conflicts, to become the masters rather than the slaves of our own lives, we must first see and remember and then forget. That is why true learning begins with unlearning. So for Bennis, we have to unlearn what we've been taught all these years. I'm grateful my two kids aren't in the audience tonight because they'd wonder what the hell they're going to school for. In order to discover what we know to be true all along. That's Bennis. Unlearn what we've been learned to dig down to what we know to be true deeply at heart. Then let's shift to Jared Diamond, whom probably most of you know from his 2005 bestseller book, Collapse. Toward the end of his big book, he talks about four types of failures in society, societies that fail to anticipate a problem when it's heading our way. Two, the failure to perceive the problem when it's already in our midst. Three, failing to solve it. And four, attempting to solve it and failing. And at the root of all those failures and all of these societies that have collapsed is a basic complacency about one's behaviors and one's belief systems. And here's what Diamond says. It's a long quote, but I think a very telling one. Here's what he says. It is painfully difficult to decide whether to abandon some of one's core values when they seem to be becoming incompatible with survival. Perhaps a crux of success or failure as a society is to know which core values to hold on to and which ones to discard and replace with new values when times change. In the last 60 years, the world's most powerful countries have given up long-held cherished beliefs previously central to their national image, while holding on to other values. Societies and individuals that succeed may be those that have the courage to take those difficult decisions and then have the luck to win their gambles. The world as a whole today faces similar decisions about its environmental problems. And finally, there's the literary critic Frank Kermode, who 35 years ago wrote a very small, thin, elegant little book called The Classic. I don't know if you know this, you're familiar with it. So what's a classic, Kermode wants to know. Kermode uses a wonderful metaphor. He says, a classic, a new classic, imagine an enormous, long bookshelf with all the canon of the world's wisdom and knowledge on this bookshelf. And a new classic is one that when you place it on this bookshelf, all the world's literature and thoughts shift slightly in place. And they look a little different, and they're located a little differently, and they're viewed through a different lens. I think it's a very beautiful metaphor. So quickly, you've got Warren Bennis. We need to unlearn what we've been taught to be true. Jared Diamond. We need to consider old social values that may have to be jettisoned in order for us to survive. And Frank Kermode. We need to author a new classic that causes all the old works of knowledge to shift. And these are the three critical moves, to my mind, of the sustainability movement. And as it turns out, these three moves have also been at the heart of my own family business in a very small way over the past 20 years. And I'd like to talk about that a little more closely. So I need you to imagine for a moment a small grocery store, corner grocery store, small, sleepy southern town. It's about 15,000 square feet. You enter in on the corner of the store, and if you look to the right as you enter that first aisle, it's a produce aisle. There's one of these big wooden latticed bins of watermelons, because after all, we're in the south. And there are these porcelain scales where you weigh your own goods. And at the very end of this produce aisle is a little prep room where people work putting out the produce. In this case, the produce department is run by Miss Hester and by a 13-year-old black African-American boy who works with Miss Hester called Tommy Brown. And if you look to the left as you come in the store, there are four checkout counters where Tommy Brown's younger brother, Eddie, bags groceries and takes them out for customers.
And this as we imagine that, I just want to interrupt for just a minute to remind our radio audience that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California, and our guest today is sustainable green buildings and communities pioneer Martin Malava. So we can go back now to our store as you're describing it, which is wonderful.
All right, so if you have this image of the small sleepy town in your head, Miss Hester running the produce department, Tommy Brown helping her out, Eddie Brown bagging groceries. Thomas Brown, or Tommy, got his first job when he was 13. Both he and his brother worked at the Feinberg supermarket, owned by Milton Feinberg and his sister Sarah Feinberg. Thomas had worked himself up from carryout boy and was now in the produce department, while Edward, who was still new, remained a carryout boy. Tommy's job was bagging potatoes. It was very simple. Every day after school and all day Saturday, he would come in the air-conditioned produce room, put on a blue smock, take a big 50-pound sack of potatoes off a huge stack of sacks, slit open the sack, and let the potatoes fall into a shopping cart next to a scale, and proceed to put them into 5- and 10-pound plastic bags. It was very simple. He could do it in his sleep. Then he would spend the rest of the day bagging potatoes and looking out of the big window, which separated the produce room from the rest of the store at the customers. He thought of the window as a one-way mirror, which allowed him to examine the people who frequented the store without being noticed himself. And it seemed as though he was never really noticed by any of them. No one ever stared back at him as he stood, only his head and shoulders visible behind the glass, looking out at the way certain hands fingered items, and the way certain feet moved, and the way some faces were set and determined while others laughed with mouths that moved in seemingly pleasant conversation. But none of them ever looked up from what they were about or even casually glanced in his direction. It was as if they could not see beyond the glass. Milton and his sister Sarah Feinberg liked him. He could tell it by the way Sarah Feinberg always called up to her office to clean. There were always rolls of coins on her desk and scattered small change on the floor when he swept, but he never touched any of it. Instead, he would gather what was on the floor and stack the coins very neatly on her desk. And when she came back into the office, Sarah B. Feinberg would smile at Thomas from behind her little glasses and say, "You're a good boy, Tommy." "I like you," Milton Feinberg told Thomas. "You're a good worker." Thomas could think of nothing to say. When you quit school, there's a place in the store for you. I ain't gonna quit school, Thomas said. Milton Feinberg smiled and chewed on his green cigar. Well, when you finish high school, you can come out to work full time. Miss Hester says you're a good worker. Yeah, says Thomas. But he was thinking of how far away he was from finishing high school and how little that long time seemed to matter to Milton Feinberg. So there's a break in the action and a crisis occurs. Eddie, the younger brother, has accidentally placed an order of groceries in the wrong car. Customer leaves without discovering the mistake, and Sarah Feinberg is furious at Eddie. So Eddie flees the front of the store and goes back into the produce department where his brother is to avoid her anger. But she follows him to vent her displeasure. Why are you back here? Miss Sarah Feinberg asked Edward. I come back for some water. You know you lost $27 worth of groceries up there? It wasn't my fault, said Eddie. If you kept your mind on what you were supposed to do, this wouldn't have happened. But no, you're always talking, always smiling around, always running your mouth with everybody. The people who got the wrong bags might bring them back, Eddie said. His nose was still sweating in the cool room. Evidently, somebody took my cart by mistake. Evidently, said Miss Sarah Feinberg. Miss Hester, you should please listen to that. Evidently. You let them go to school and they think they know everything. Evidently, you say? Yeah, said Eddie. Thomas saw that he was about to cry. You get back up front, said Miss Sarah Feinberg. And she shoved her way through the door again and out of the cool produce room. I'm going home, said Eddie. You ain't quitting, said Miss Hester. Yeah. What for? I don't know. Just got to go home. But don't your folk need the money? No, Eddie said. He took off his blue smock and laid it on the big pile of 50-pound potato sacks. I'm going home, he said again. He did not look at his brother. He walked through the door, and Thomas watched him walk slowly down the produce aisle and then out the front door without looking at anything at all. You going to quit too, Tommy? Asked Miss Hester. No, he said. I guess your folks do need the money now, huh? No, he said. We don't need the money. Thomas did not want to think about his brother or his mother or the money. He decided it would be necessary to record the faces and bodies of new people as they wandered selectively with their shopping carts beyond the big window glass. He liked it very much now that none of them ever looked up and saw him watching. That way he did not ever have to feel embarrassment or guilt. That way he would never have to feel compelled to nod his head or move his mouth or eyes or make any indication of a greeting to them. That way he would never have to feel bad when they did not speak back. I would love to be able to claim that prose as my own. It's not. It actually belongs to the writing of James Allen McPherson, Pulitzer Prize-winning author. This is from his first collection of short stories called Hue and Cry. It's the first chapter. McPherson, the author, actually resembles Tommy a good bit. McPherson grew up in Savannah, Georgia, went on to study law at Harvard, and earned an MFA from the University of Iowa, where he now teaches creative writing. McPherson doesn't often come back to his hometown. He's taken stock of where he grew up and has moved on. When McPherson was about Tommy's age, he worked in a local grocery store, the M&M Food Store, which became M&M Supermarkets, which became Malava Inc., which is the company that I run. Milton and Sarah Feinberg are apparently modeled after my father and my grandmother. And as a kid, I remember family members once referring, only once, to this story. And the sort of negative betrayal, maybe. And it was mentioned casually. It appeared in the book, and that was it, never to mention again. And it took me 30 years to pick up that book and actually read it for myself. And I discovered a lot of things in reading it. One, it's not easy to read somewhat unflattering, strongly unflattering pictures of people you love and care for, particularly those who were pretty strong in the civil rights movement, but from another perspective. And it's tough to see Jewish merchants characterized in a fairly negative light. But you also saw a lot of nuances in the reading of the book that was captured around my family table back then. And it's interesting the way certain truths are handed down to us and blithely accepted without our ever making the effort to delve deeper. And that's really where I want to move with this story. I remember in ninth grade when we were studying Roman and Greek mythology, my ninth grade teacher said, well, it's funny laughing at these mythologies people are creating about sunrise and the seasons and stuff like that. Are there any myths that we hold true today? And we all laughed, you know, myths, us, modern, us. We're way too modern to believe in myths. And it's funny how those moments from long ago stay with you, stay with me. And I think about that moment from ninth grade a lot. I think about it a lot running the company and the 20 years that I've been involved with my company. So, for instance, how many of us gave little thought to GDP and GNP as a true measure of social progress and prosperity? And how many of us now understand implicitly that these are distorted economic markers that completely disregard social and ecological capital? That there is something wrong when the funds expended to, say, clean up the Valdez is counted in the GNP, but never take into account all the negative results of what occurred? And how about the notion of unlimited progress and growth, unlimited natural capital, and the rightness of businesses competing in a global economy to do whatever they want? And the so-called inalienable right of property, the notion that various natural resources, such as water, can be owned irrespective of a larger common good. How about the shareholder theory of business that holds that a company should only be beholden to a narrow group of stockholders? The notion that the sole purpose of business is to maximize profit for a narrow group of people. The belief that we all have equal access to a democratic system of government that has been structured to watch over the interests of the ordinary citizen. I loved my course when I was an MBA student and talking about corrupt developing countries around the globe where you had to pay bribes as the cost of entry into business, whereas our own lobbying efforts are viewed as a very respectable practice. The notion that we only go to war for strongly moral reasons and not to protect narrow economic interests, such as stable supply and so-called fair pricing of oil. The notion that corporations are legally viewed as individuals, insulated by the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, something it was never intended to do. That a business has to be big in order to be successful. That it had to compete mercilessly and guard its competitive advantage zealously. That an agricultural industrial complex that can deliver me a diet of cheap food, fertilized to the max and laden with high fructose corn syrup, is a wonder of modern engineering and distribution. That consumption equals happiness. The belief that there is a there out there we can discard our waste without any repercussions. The notion that Lake Chad or the Aral Sea or the Arctic would always be there. That our glaciers would be around for our grandkids to see, that a high quality of life is assured for generations to come. Truth to be told, 20 years ago, when I first started running Malav Rink, none of this crossed my head, not a smidgen. I simply wanted to take over a business that was started by my grandmother in 1940s, a corner grocery store, and built up by my father, second generation, and make sure it continued on in an ethical fashion. We also had two other objectives in addition to the notion of just basic continuity. First, as we migrated from a grocery business into a real estate business in the mid-1980s, we sold the grocery business, we decided as a family that if we were going to continue in the real estate business, we had to do it differently. Either we were going to exit it or we were going to do it differently. And second, we had to have a positive effect, both society and the natural world. We wanted work to be meaningful, to make a difference in our community. And that's how mission-based businesses get rolling. And it's funny, as you begin to do that, how much you unlearn the so-called wisdoms that you've inherited, the mythologies of what business practices are all about. That's how you begin to write a new story. With apologies to our steel case person in the audience, I'm going to cite actually a competitor, Max Dupree, who's the former head of Herman Miller, author of another one of my favorite books, Leadership is an Art. And he once wrote the following. The best people working for organizations are like volunteers. They choose to work somewhere for reasons less tangible than salary or position. Volunteers do not need contracts. They need covenants. Covenantal relationships induce freedom, not paralysis. A covenantal relationship rests on shared commitment to ideas, to issues, to values, to goals, and to management process. Words such as love, warmth, personal chemistry are certainly pertinent. Covenantal relationships fill deep needs and they enable work to have meaning and to be fulfilling. It's really one of my absolutely favorite quotes, and although we don't have it up on our website or on our door, I think that would sort of capture the essence of Malava Rink for me anyway. And that notion of covenants, creating a sense of covenants within a company, has a whole set of tenets that seem to carry with it. First and foremost, businesses should recover a fundamental sense of the places in which they operate. They should be of place. Businesses should also recover a fundamental sense of people with whom they engage, replacing a narrow notion of shareholder theory with a broader one of stakeholder accountability. Businesses should restrain a typical tendency to grow beyond its natural means, to work within its organic structure. Businesses should shape a collective sense of meaning and purpose. And that means by amalgamating the diverse voices within an organization, not just from me, but from everyone I work with, to create a sense of collective purpose and meaning. And beyond that, businesses should engage a broader sense of meaning and purpose for the community as a whole, with the people we come into contact with, the people we do business with, our partners, our clients, customers, etc. And then beyond that, businesses should work with other major sectors of society, not only other businesses, in a collaborative sense, but governments, civil service organizations, academia, faith-based organizations, in order to work collectively as stewards and trustees of nature and community. And what I've described is a basic rippling out of effect, where the covenants you create within an organization among yourselves begin to radiate outward in expanding fashion until you leverage a business to create change as stewards and trustees of a larger order. And that pretty much, that radiating outward, that rippling out effect, describes how we work, or we try to work, really, as agents of change. It serves to rewrite many of the outdated assumptions, the mythologies, if you will, of what a business should do, what its responsibilities are, and how it should perform. So, for instance, instead of feeling proprietary about what we've learned, we simply put it out there and share our experiences, and mostly our mistakes, with whomever will listen. Instead of having a hierarchical leadership, we have a very flat structure. Leadership comes from everyone in the organization. We all take collective responsibility. Instead of trying to go for boom growth, we focus on the quality of our work and thinking. Instead of a single financial bottom line, multiple bottom lines. In fact, I would say that as we evolved as a company, we began to unlearn the typical rules of the road for running a business. You have to maximize profits. There has to be one leader who is the face of the company. You have to create a need for the products you want to sell rather than address true need within a community. You have to grow bigger, grow faster, or be eaten by others. Follow the money, take on equity partners, take on more debt, build a portfolio of national and international credit-worthy tenants, and a whole lot more rubbish. Yvon Chouinard, who's the founder of Patagonia, once said the following, "I learned at an early age that it's better to invent your own game than you can always be a winner." And I think we found that not only to be true, but also necessary. I think a sustainable revolution can only come about by jettisoning the rules of an old and outworn mythology and replace those rules with something more humane, more in harmony with our larger context, something more purposeful. And that's what we mean about living above the store, where business is intimately and inextricably tied to the community, where what one does for a living, where one works, flows seamlessly into where one plays, where one commutes with others, with family, with extended members, where work, live, play, secular and sacred are all interrelated. I thought I'd end on a fairly personal note and open up for questions. Even at the best of times, being a mission-driven company based on covenants is not the easiest road to hoe. I can remember when I was a kid going to my mother's parents who lived in Americus. My grandfather owned a clothing store in Americus, Georgia, that basically sold clothes to the farmers in the area, overalls, dingo boots, things like that. I used to go in the store on Sundays, try on all these clothes, and come back to Savannah with all a bunch of clothes from the store, which is what I wear to school. I thought it was wonderful when I was in America. I got back to school, and I looked completely ridiculous, And I kept wondering, what the hell am I doing, and why am I wearing this stuff, et cetera. And I think my colleagues and I have a general sense of the same feeling, have had that same sense over the years of, you know, why are we adhering to the beat of a different drummer, if you will? Why are we sort of shackling ourselves to a whole different set of standards that are make it more difficult to do business sometimes, make it everything is much more deliberative, more thoughtful, slower, involving more people, very frustrating at times. And that's at the best of times. And these aren't the best of times, for sure. For the last year and a half, and probably for the next year and a half to come, it's been a rough haul. And for the first time in my almost 20 years as running the company, and this is a very deliberate phrase, we've had to let people go. Oftentimes that's a euphemism. This was literally a let people go. And I've never believed entirely in tenure. I've always believed in lifelong employment for people's vocational evolution. And this last year has been the toughest year in my 20 years running the company. And I feel in a basic way that that covenantal relationship that Max Dupree talks about is a covenant that I have bent to the point of having a hard time straightening out. I feel like I have let down my colleagues who are with me, my colleagues who I have let go, and let down myself, among other things. And for sure, talking inspirational language during this time doesn't fly. You know, we are fighting for basic day-to-day kind of put out the fire stuff and, you know, giving a sort of, you know, we are carrying a banner for sustainability and thought and product leaders for the nation is not a message anyone wants to hear right now. So I'm grateful to come here instead. But as Ray Anderson eloquently points out, you can't make a business case for the way things have evolved since the Industrial Revolution. It doesn't exist. It's a story that's run its course, even if our new stories have yet to be fully written, even if we've yet to manage through some of the bumps in the road along the way. And I want to say to my colleagues, through you today, that we are in the process of writing one of those new stories. It's just a matter of time. Thank you.
For our radio audience, you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California, and our guest today is Sustainable Green Buildings and Communities Pioneer, Martin Malaba, and we will move now to questions from the audience.
Hi, thanks very much for your wonderful comments, Martin. My first question is, what would be the difference in your view? How much more difficult would it be for you to do your triple bottom line and your ethical, sustainable business practices if you were a publicly traded corporation and had thousands of demanding shareholders to satisfy compared to a family firm?
I mean, I think, you know, for most publicly traded companies that are still working on quarter-to-quarter returns, I think it's a major uphill battle. I think for the few companies out there that have longer time horizons, it's certainly much easier. You are getting some interesting shareholder action from pension funds, large institutional investors that are pushing triple bottom line agendas. CalPERS, whom you're familiar with, is probably a good example of that. But for sure, it's much easier as a privately held company to take a, not a quarter-to-quarter, but a multi-year approach. I mean, even during this downturn, you know, there's not a question. I mean, we're staying the course. There's not even a question about that. I think it's much harder when you're publicly traded to be pushing that. I wish that weren't the case, but I think that's still true.
Hi, Martin.
Hey there.
So you talk about the generation aspect to your business. What do you see among business, the new generation of business leaders? Are they reacting differently? Are they being exposed to this environment and this economy, and so therefore this talk of sustainability resonates with them because they haven't seen the advantage, you know, of what we all had probably in the 80s that kept us going far faster and longer than we should have. But what are you seeing out there for the new business leaders?
God, I have to break that down into about a million different categories. I mean, I think there's clearly there is a good bit of traction in the sustainability movement and among leaders. I mean, you know, everyone trots out Jeff Immelt, et cetera, and, you know, Walmart, et cetera. And so that's old guard, if you will. On the other end of the spectrum, you know, you've got recent graduates of the Presidio, and clearly they're getting, you know, Kool-Aid, sustainable Kool-Aid, green Kool-Aid, every day of the week, which is great. And I think over the long term, there's a wonderful quote from Stuart Brand's book about, you know, are things getting better or are they getting worse? And he says, things are getting better slowly when he takes, like, you know, 100-year time frame. And I think that over the long haul, I think there's clearly a lot of movement in a green, sustainable direction. I think there are a number of real, I mean, it's not going to be linear. I think one of the questions that I have, and I think probably most people have, is, you know, as the economy recovers, what is that going to look like in terms of corporate behavior? Are you going to find, you know, this sort of desperate attempt to regain super profitability as fast as possible, you know, damn the torpedoes kind of approach? Or are you going to have a more thoughtful approach to growth? And in that question is what the restructuring of the financial marketplace is going to look like. I mean, for us, one of the things that we have, and it's right there on my agenda, and I know one in my company wants to talk about right now because we're in the trenches, but the main focus for me, for instance, is really partnering with an alternative financing structure, one that is invested in community over the long haul. And I just had a conversation with George before we started this along those lines. And I think some of that sustainability movement is going to be caught up in what reforms occur within the financial community. And I think you're going to see alternative approaches, a lot more emphasis on, you know, local economies, not just locavore, but full-blown Bally-type approaches to business. And I think you're going to see more and more of that coming down the pike.
Hi, Martin. Following along that line, do you see some new, specific new financial models emerging, some new ways of funding that are coming up that you are using or able to use for your business or are informing informing this time of trying to invent new business when the resources appear quite scarce?
Yes, absolutely. Actually, there's a whole chapter in Hazel Henderson's book, Ethical Marketplace, that picks up on a number of organizations that are borrowing a page from the Grameen microfinance mechanism only at a larger scale. So there are a number. It's starting to bubble up. Two to three years ago, there was really a movement afoot, if you will, to create some green funds. And for the most part, you know, that just got caught in a major hurricane, obviously, and that just got hit dead. Having said that, I think I know of at least one group out of Boulder that we're working with that began to say, you know, having a green fund, and now we're talking about just real estate, so I'm very focused on real estate for the moment. You know, a green fund, okay, fine. You know, you got investors, you know, who are going to invest in LEED buildings. You know, that's nice, but that really doesn't get systemically at what needs to have happen. So we really need to use this downturn to rethink and refocus the whole structure. So what this one company is doing out of Boulder is saying, what we want to do is go back to an old mercantile banking concept where your bank is very much an extension of you as a business, very invested in the community for the long haul. And then rather than exiting once a deal has been consummated and loans have been paid off, those funds are reinvested in the community in the form of evolving, revolving lines of credit and investing in jobs, et cetera. So you're seeing a good bit of that. George, do you want to kind of – I mean, George and I were just talking about that beforehand.
Yeah, I'm only briefly familiar with some of the things that are going on here in the Bay Area through our RSF Social Finance, but very much along that same line, but beyond debt into a, kind of another level of stock exchange, if you want to call it, an equity kind of mechanism similar to microfinancing. And it's in its early stages. About all I know about it, but there's a lot of movement in these different financing sources of financing for small businesses.
Right. I mean, Investor Circle obviously is a known. Woody Tash has got this nascent movement afoot called Slow Money, which is really based on food. So you're getting the crux of it. Really, comes down when you talk about. If I link it back to my talk on. Unhinging a basic mythology of the golden rule. And I'm not talking about do unto others golden rule. I'm talking about he who has the gold rules. And until you unhinge that basic premise of capital finance, you're stuck in an old mythology, an old model. And what you really need, and you're beginning to see, is rather than have investors over on the left, amalgamators or brokers, finance brokers in the middle, and the people looking for capital in the end, and they never meet, is literally to create a round table where investor, amalgamator, broker, whatever you want to call it, and user are all at the table together to agree on multiple bottom line metrics for what needs to be done. And that's what, you know, if I asked you, you know, you can invest in something, but, you know, your capital – you're not going to have the typical three-year exit strategy. You're going to invest for the long haul. And by the way, you're not going to maximize necessarily your return. You're going to balance your financial return by other metrics, social, environmental. You know, a lot of environmental groups. I'm chair of the Georgia Conservancy right now. Their endowment is not where it needs to be because their attitude is we need as much money as we can to serve do the good fight on environmental stuff. He says, wait a second, but if you're invested in Southern Company and you're getting funds from Southern Company in order to, if I'm offending anyway from Southern Company, I apologize, in order to do your good work in the Southeast, that ain't going to cut it. So there's a whole unlearning of how that financial mechanism works that needs to occur.
I have a question about unlearning. It's a nitty-gritty question. In the beginning of work, how did you overcome resistance from owners, builders, architects, contractors, trade people, and build confidence in learning and using new sustainable models? And my nitty-gritty example is how did you do it in terms of sustainable toilets and plumbing?
Okay. The first thing is you work inside out. You work internally. In other words, you got to get your own house in order before you do anything. You know, if you start by talking before you're walking, you're dead out of the gate. So we spent a long time, and still do, making sure we've got things right within the culture. That's first and foremost. And then once we do that, things begin to kind of work. There's a certain magic to it. I know that's not very satisfying. But we'll do, we did the first lead retail development in the country. And, you know, the city was aghast at what we were doing, first time out of the box. Now they're thrilled. You know, anytime we want to, and then they've rewritten their whole plumbing code to use gray water as an acceptable part of a strategy in Savannah, Georgia. We're not talking about the Bay Area now. We're talking about Savannah, Georgia. Because they recognize that that's a reduced strain, reducing their strain, reducing their use of infrastructure. So I think the key is, you know, first get it right internally, get some demonstration projects that people can touch and feel and get comfortable with. And yeah, I mean, there's always that voicemail from someone complaining about, you know, the waterless urinal is, you know, messed up his pair of pants. And, you know, we owe him for $500 of dry cleaning, but that tends to be, at this point, fairly anecdotal and fairly the exception to the rule. Did I get that in? Does that help?
I
don't know.
Thank you.
It seems like there's a lot of learning still to be done out there in the business community as well. I was just at an Urban Land Institute meeting yesterday with a bunch of deal makers and people that have thrived on spreading out the deals, just delocalizing the capital, and just making things happen. And yet, it felt like there's still lessons not learned. The addiction wasn't there. It's like, okay, we're going to have to wait a little bit longer this time, but the potential is still there. I mean, the laws and the system still encourages the profit as the ultimate goal. And the example they brought up was, okay, well, we can't rent out to a big box company because they're not there anymore. Chop up them all into little pieces, and you can really screw the little guys because they're illiterate enough about the deal and art of deal making. So, I mean, do we need a bigger systemic change? Does it, you know, you can educate the city on the codes. How do we get to the next level?
I mean, David Orr, who I'm going to be doing a joint session with in a couple of weeks, I'm really excited about, is one of a handful of voices out there that talks about the sustainable revolution really coming down to an ethical paradigm shift. And, you know, that doesn't happen overnight. And I think that's an interesting dilemma because, you know, you've got this movement, this 350 Orr that's trying to reduce parts per million, you know, carbon from 385, 390 down to 350. You know, we're so moving in the other direction right now and getting, as my mom was fond of saying when I was a kid, you know, you can't crash diet. You know, you've got to change your entire way of living. And that doesn't happen overnight. So you've got this real tension between some of the systemic paradigmatic change you're talking about, which I think is very long-term, and some of the immediate acute needs like reduction of carbon emissions and stuff like that. And I'm looking forward to asking David that very question in a couple of weeks because I don't know how you square those two. They both need to happen, clearly. You know, you can't take the short-term and ignore the long-term, but you can't just, you know, go after the long-term and ignore the obvious, you know, immediate issues of carbon emissions. I don't know if that helped at all.
You've alluded a couple of times this evening to the situation that we find ourselves in as a society with the economic collapse and highest unemployment rates we've seen in decades and people's retirement funds vaporizing and so on. Most of the people in this room, I suspect, are the choir. We're not having to change anybody's mind in this room, but there's a critical mass out there who's feeling very frightened right now, insecure, certainly very uncertain about change. What can we what story can we tell to those people to give them hope and encouragement that the change will be a better change and not put them further into the hole and make their situation worse?
Yeah, I mean, you know, not to be overly Dickensian, but this is really, you know, the most humbling of times. It's also the most opportunistic of times. I think it really is. I think if you actually ended up writing a chapter in a book that's actually a bunch of academic essays except for mine, says if you look at the basic story to date, you know, Joe and Jane Citizen moving to find cheap housing somewhere outside of town, outside the urban core, and the cascading consequences of that one move. It's cheaper to buy, you know, an hour from town than not. And the incredibly linked, dense web of connections as a result of that one connection. And to tell that story very simply in language that most people can understand. Time in the car, away from the kids, more burning of oil, no exercise, greater obesity. I mean, it just runs the gamut, a whole host of decisions. I think once that story is told very clearly, people begin to get the picture of what's not working. I mean, I think one of the challenges is that I think we are, except for probably this audience and people like this audience, very few people have got a very integrated sense of the way one's life, pieces of one's life fit together into a fabric that's very dislocative and non-workable. I think that's part one. It's just to be able to very eloquently, simply put that picture together. And part two is to point to examples out there, and they do exist, of communities. I think of Bellingham, Washington as one, for instance, it just kind of pops to mind, of where a citizenry has really figured out ways to create synergies among everything they do and to begin to show that it's not so difficult to make it work. Just one simple example, if we've got time, is I've used this once before. We're doing an affordable housing project, one of the first green affordable housing projects in the nation, a very cool project. At some point, we said, you know, you got to look beyond the footprint of this project itself. You got to look at the context around it. Well, in this case, there was a paper mill right across the road, and the paper mill was drawing down 25 million gallons of water per day for its use. A ton of water. Okay, well, what if we created a waste treatment center on site of our development that takes rainwater and wastewater, treats it to tertiary standards, and not just for our development, for the whole neighborhood, and sends it across the road to the paper mill for its use? The paper mill reduces its use of draw of water, right? The city reduces its use of infrastructure, so the city loved it, and the residents said, you know what, as a result, we'll take the excess steam from the paper mill and convert it to electricity and send it back across the road, and we'll be off the grid. And little synergistic statistic stories like that all of a sudden begin to pop people's eyes up and go, whoa. You know, simple things like, you know, gymnasiums that are used by schools and by after school and parking lots that are used by hotels and offices, and you begin to multiply the uses of resources rather than multiply the resources themselves. And we're not telling those stories as eloquently as we need to, I think, but they pop.
Unfortunately, we have reached the point in our program where there is time for only one last question. And again, welcome to our radio audience. This is the Commonwealth Club of California.
I'm going to take the privilege of the last question. So you're in the development business, so you know those LEED guidelines in and out. The LEED, for the listening audience, LEED is the building standards for sustainable buildings. And so my question for you is, as a developer who's had to work with this and make things happen, would it be better to have more government direction on those kinds of things? Because that was a bottoms-up kind of industry-initiated standard.
Is that? Yeah, in fact, USGBC, as you know, has traditionally not been in favor of having those standards mandated by municipal or regional governments. They'd rather it be a sort of, but I think, one, you're seeing, you know, plenty of municipalities and states beginning to mandate it more and more. I think the real question is going to be not, I think clearly, is not new construction, because I think new construction, either by just basic ordinances or by laws, are going to be lead or lead-like, is going to be what are we doing with existing stock and what needs to be done with that. And there are a lot of ways to get at that. I mean, if you have an intelligent carbon tax or trade policy, it may get us there. My guess is that you're probably going to need a little more stick to go with the carrots to get us there. And I think probably given our need to reduce carbon emissions, I'd be pushing that. I don't think we have a choice.
Thank you. You've been listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. And our speaker has been Martin Malaver, CEO of Malaver, Inc., and the author of the new book, Living Above the Store. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, observing over a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.